Just if you go ahead with Rob's introduction, thank you.
Sure, sure, sure. So my name is Brady McCartney. I have introduced, invited Rob Bennett, the CEO, the founding CEO of Eco Districts, based in Portland, Oregon, to join us for the call today. I was first introduced to his work when I was living and working in San Francisco, and it became very clear to me that Rob and Eco Districts, although at the time they were named the Portland Sustainability Institute, were doing something that was pretty unique, really trying to figure out how to bring sort of environmental issues into sort of a conversation about economic development and community planning and city planning and sort of real estate development. It seems like Eco Districts had a really interesting take on it, and clearly Rob and others were the driving force in Portland, and they were clearly having an impact beyond. So I wanted to, bring Rob Bennett into the BART MBA program because I think he's coming at this issue or these series of issues from a pretty unique perspective. So Rob, if you would, just let us know what you've been up to.
Sure. Thanks for the introduction, guys. And it's a pleasure to be speaking with you all today. So my name is Rob Bennett. I am the CEO of a small nonprofit called Eco Districts. We are in Portland, Oregon. And for the last 20 plus years, this has been my home, with the exception of some time up in Vancouver, BC, working on the Olympic Village redevelopment project ahead of the Olympics, the 2010 Olympics. What we're trying to do with Eco Districts, and really what's behind the organization, is a very simple idea that we need to, in order to accelerate the green city or sustainable city agenda, we need to also emphasize what happens at the neighborhood level through redevelopment. So our mission is simple. It's to accelerate district or neighborhood scale sustainable development projects. And the way we go about our work and how we think we can have impact is to recognize that at the neighborhood level, there's a tremendous amount of investment that happens that influences how neighborhoods sort of work or in some cases don't work. And we want to be very explicit about cracking into that supply chain and those sectors that make those investments, and to start to encourage them and ultimately build systems, whether they be sort of frameworks of implementation or new finance or policy tools, to encourage the embedding of sustainable development outcomes or metrics to guide that work. So that's really at the heart of the organization's mission, is to really be a disruptive force in how neighborhood revitalization happens, with an emphasis of this disruption on getting much more explicit sustainable development outcomes. The way we define this work is through a framework that we created, quite modestly to begin as a pilot program here in Portland. We were hired in 2009 to develop what the mayor had at the time, sort of a vague notion of innovation districts. He was interested in Portland taking the next step in sustainable development and recognized the sort of neighborhood scale as a place to do it. We had a rich history of advancing green buildings and really helping to transform the market so that green buildings became business as usual in Portland. We have a rich history of urban land planning and regional growth management. And at the neighborhood level, we had been really just practicing the same kind of urban redevelopment for many, many years, primarily through the Portland Development Commission. And most cities, or many cities in the country and around the world, have development authorities that are working on revitalization at the neighborhood level, but they're using pretty traditional tools of land assembly and tax increment financing to help support sort of nodal or, in some cases, catalytic development sort of lot by lot. We thought that was an opportunity to have a new conversation about how the district and how urban redevelopment authorities can influence change and to do it with, again, sustainable development metrics sort of at the heart of it. So our framework that we created for the Portland pilot and the mayor's office and the city has really become the engine room for the work that we do. It's a very simple four-step process that starts with how you assemble and organize people, and then ultimately how you do very detailed assessment work and identify projects. What sits on top of all of that are what we have is 8 performance areas to the work. So we spent the better part of 2009 and 10 in consultation with industry, with nonprofits, with cities to develop that framework and those standards. And that ultimately in the last 4 years has really guided the work of the organization. So fast forward from 2010 to today, and what's different about where we started and where we're at now is what we took as a modest sort of pilot program with the city of Portland, and it's now very much kind of sweeping across the country and to a certain extent globally, this notion of eco-districts. And you can spend 3 minutes Googling eco-districts and you'll come up with projects all over the place that are claiming to be eco-districts, that have ambition to be eco-districts, from New York City to San Francisco, a World UNESCO Heritage Site in the Philippines, to a redevelopment in Ottawa, Ontario. It's clear that there seems to be a real interest in this notion of eco-districts and embedding sustainability. And, of course, the next question is, well, what are people doing and how are they defining success? And that's the place that we are spending most of our energy today, is recognizing that there's tremendous market demand to doing these kinds of projects. In some cases, they're being driven by developers. In other cases, they're being driven by downtown business interests who manage real estate, or better known as business improvement districts. In some cases, they're being driven by corporations like Google as they build out their Mountain View campus. And so there's very interesting kind of channels in which eco-districts are being explored and ultimately manifest. And our role as a nonprofit intermediary in this space is to help give better definition and better clarity about performance and ultimately rewarding excellence in this space. Otherwise, it will be very disorganized, and I think we'll be missing opportunities to create a marketplace. We're taking our cues in our work and how we execute on this, from other efforts that have gone forward, those who helped define the smart growth movement in this country, and to a certain extent have provided a lot of direction about both legislating and providing design guidance around smart growth. Likewise with those who are, who helped build the green building movement and the sort of obviously the power of LEED and how that created a very clear standard and template of success and performance. So the organization is right now spending a majority of our time in two areas. One is launching a North American pilot program, what we're calling Target Cities, and the other is reworking our framework that we built in 2010 into what we're calling a global standard for eco-districts. We're building the organization out, we're hiring, we're fundraising, we're doing all the work that a nonprofit like ours needs to do to be able to execute on the work. And it's been a really satisfying part of my career. I started in 1992 as a community organizer in the neighborhood system here in Portland, and got really interested in the issues of urbanization and how community activists and community sort of citizen entrepreneurial sort of interface with decisions that happen sometimes certainly outside of their purview, whether it be development decisions or municipal investments that happen. So this is, in a way, a 20-year sort of coming full circle for me, where I've been at the intersection of public policy and real estate, neighborhood organizing, and really exemplar projects like the Olympic Village in Vancouver, which, was a really interesting experience of working on the very technical and sort of structural outcomes that you're seeking for sustainable development in the areas of infrastructure and buildings. You know, we were able to build a new neighborhood that reduced carbon emissions by 60% and had a return on investment of 7 or 8% for the utility. You know, these are kinds of game changer projects that you really start to see the sort of twinning of an environmental agenda with a social agenda and with obviously an economic agenda. And that's really what this organization is trying to do, is to build and support projects that are really starting to inform the next generation of best practice and starting to make the business case for you know, for projects that, you know, up until recently, many people are not paying attention to the details of how you execute, you know, a high performance neighborhood. So maybe I'll stop there. I guess, you know, let's see, what time is it? Yeah, it's about 9:15 here on the West Coast, and if you want me to continue, just let me know. But maybe this is a good stopping point to get into some questions.
That was great. If you would, Rob, again, this is Brady. If you could talk a little bit about the incubator process that you all have started, I assume the Target Cities initiative.
Sure.
It's maybe an outgrowth of the success you've had with that. But I guess what I've been most struck by with EcoDistricts is the fact that, you know, you are this small little organization, you know, what, 6 staff members, and, you know, you have a pretty well-established board. But the way that the organization has sort of framed this new conversation, even the term EcoDistricts, you now, as you said, you see it nationally and worldwide. And it's hard for me to figure out how you have had such an impact. You know, was it right place, right time, being in Portland and having the support of the former mayor and also, you know, sort of Portland State and some of the local communities? Like, why do you think, you know, you've been able to sort of scale this up and go from, you know, this incubator project and now to this Target Cities? It seems like, you know, you've just done a lot with a little, and it's pretty impressive.
Yeah, you know, we have done a lot with a little. I think there's some trends in play that, you know, we're sort of tapping into. You know, obviously global urbanization, the speed in which cities are growing. You know, obviously it's not in every city in this country, certainly, but the fact that we are rapidly urbanizing at the same time where cities over the last 10 years with, you know, with the leadership of President Clinton and Michael Bloomberg and others, you know, are finally taking, you know, the climate change challenge very seriously. And it's, you know, it's obviously being manifest in very significant ways as far as the impact of the city. So you have, you know, you have this sort of attention on this, you know, needing to solve both a tremendous growth challenge and also doing it in a way that reduces environmental and social impacts. There's also other trends like the deepening of the equity conversation becoming a very serious part of how sustainable development is viewed and the kind of work that happens. So you just have a lot going on, lots of best practices, social, you know, entrepreneurials, crowdfunding platforms, you know, moving from 3 to 1,700 in about, you know, 5 years, you know, the whole sharing economy and the sort of entrepreneurialism that the tech industry has both brought to, you know, and the energy sectors, but also to the, just, you know, how we live. All of this is happening, I think, as, you know, what I would consider this notion of, you know, a deep experiment that, you know, sort of a city lab experiment that's just exploding globally. So EcoDistricts is really tapping into that, and I think we're giving, to a certain extent, a definition for that at the neighborhood level. I would say, too, which I think is just important for framing, that the way we're building our organization is to be very clear that what we mean by sustainability is truly embedding you know, the economics, the environmental outcomes, and the social outcomes. We feel, and one reason that we, you know, have been able to assemble such a great board of directors and attract talent is we really feel that you know, we've just been sub-optimized. You see tremendous activity in the social justice and environmental justice arena, brownfield redevelopment, you know, really giving voice to communities that have been disempowered. You obviously see tremendous amounts of resources and innovation happening in the energy and the green building sectors. We're recognizing the sort of vulnerability and the benefit of robust neighborhoods in helping, helping be determinants of what quality of life means, whether it's from a public health standard and being able to walk and play in your neighborhood, to the kinds of connections between people that, you know, were really important when you saw what happened in New York and during Katrina. You know, either the social infrastructure was there or it's not, and it really determines the speed in which the neighborhoods recover. All of those things are sort of very much part of what we want to sort of bring together in a more cogent agenda. But, you know, I would say, you know, we're really tapping into something very deep and very exciting, and that's, I think, one reason we frankly look bigger than we are, and we're able to have hopefully more impact than a normally, you know, small organization would have. Our success ultimately will be determined by our partnerships. And so just let me give you a little bit of what we're doing on that front. You mentioned Target City. So Target City is really, you know, the next generation pilot program, you know, that started modestly, like I said, in Portland, and now we're going to sort of reach out to 8 to 10 projects across North America and really work with them on embedding the EcoDistrix framework and the performance metrics. This is our opportunity to define what we think success is and to work with some catalytic projects and ultimately try to build a notion of what performance and success and innovation looks like, so that all those ecodistricts that are claiming to be ecodistricts out there really have something to shoot towards and look towards. And the framework ultimately becomes the performance benchmarking that, you know, will be made available to all folks. The incubator is really a program that we launched in Portland to invite project teams to come to Portland and to work on their project, to be introduced to some great leaders in the sustainable development neighborhood space, and really, probably most importantly, spend time with their team to advance a project that might be at the front end. So that becomes a way to draw project teams, multidisciplinary project teams, into the EcoDistrix work and to start to embed the framework and the performance metrics. So that's very much an executive level training program. Target Cities is going to be a much more deep 2-year engagement. Our summit and our trainings become opportunities to grow the community of practice and, you know, build an army of champions that are cross-disciplinary, from, you know, the affordable housing sectors to real estate to municipal sustainability. For us to be successful, we need to be very clear about the sectors that we think matter in making neighborhoods go and making sure they feel that they're part of the EcoDistrix work. It's a multi-sector approach, and it's difficult because most of these sectors work in their, you know, within their trade groups and within their supply chain of delivering buildings or delivering a housing or delivering infrastructure. They don't tend to view themselves as part of a bigger ecosystem, but, you know, I mean, they do so conceptually, but they don't tend to professionally, and that's a big problem that we're trying to overcome with EcoDistrix, is to get more alignment with those who make investments at the neighborhood level and use a common framework for that work so that their investments have more impact. And that, you know, that in and of itself requires us to be hyper collaborative and build national partnerships, which, you know, at the end of the day is how we think we're going to have more impact and look bigger than we are, because we're working with NRDC and we're working with Policy Link and we're working with U.S. Green Building Council and Center for Neighborhood Technology and, you know, Center for Active Transportation, et cetera. So we're going to deepen this work by looking to the very partners who will ultimately have the bandwidth and the sort of their networks to go faster.
We've got Rachel Warren, sure. Brady McCartney, our students, asking questions today. This is Evan Goodstein. I'm director of the program. And could you just sort of give us what's the best concrete example of an eco district? sort of what does that mean? You know, what would, is it is an interwoven network of green businesses, or how would you best describe it?
Sure, that's a great question. And we, continue. Is there more to the question?
Is there a neighborhood in Portland that you would refer to as the model eco district?
Yeah, so it's a good question. And the way we define eco districts is one of creating a public-private civic partnership to execute on sustainable development projects. So we don't define it as a, you know, as a sort of as a finished product. We view it very much as a process. So with that context, you know, there's a range of what I would consider exemplar eco-district projects. If you start with the easiest projects to sort of define, or you go to the brownfield projects like the Olympic Village in Vancouver, what we call Southeast Falls Creek, or Malmo's Western Harbor in Malmo, Sweden, or Hammarbystad in Stockholm. These are projects that were brownfield projects that really advanced the notion of integrated systems between buildings and infrastructure. And in some cases, on the social dimensions, you know, many of them have a mix of affordable housing, senior housing, you know, mix of retail, you know, community amenities like schools and community centers. So those sort of new projects that are really advancing eco-districts principles and best practices in the areas of complete streets, water management, carbon reductions, social dimensions of mixing incomes, class, and providing the very services and, you know, amenities to have a good life. Those are eco-districts as far as we're concerned. Now, you know, most of those didn't use the 8 performance areas that we created because they all predate that, but you know, there's a lot to learn from some of these, what I call them, sort of version 1 eco-districts. You know, now fast forward to the work that we've been doing in Portland. The Lloyd eco-district is a good example. This is a primarily commercial-serving neighborhood. It's managed by a business improvement district. It is, if you were to walk through it today, you would think this is nothing but a pretty lousy second-tier commercial district in a city. It's got a lot of vacant lots and underutilized buildings. It's got, you know, kind of a set of super blocks. So, it's, you know, from an urban realm perspective, it's not that attractive. But what they've done is they've made a commitment across the business improvement district, which includes really powerful interests like Kaiser Permanente, like our local electric utility, like our state government and regional government that have offices there, like the Portland Trailblazers that play, you know, the professional basketball franchise in the convention center. They have all made a commitment to being an eco district and starting to manage their neighborhood, if you will, as a combined asset. They've hired eco district staff. They've created a nonprofit to manage and govern the work, and they are now executing on a series of projects and an assessment, including a deep energy reduction strategy in which they have committed voluntarily to meeting the 2030 challenge of the district. So they're now on a path to reducing carbon emissions down to zero by 2030 as just one of their projects. So we consider that a emergent eco-district success story because they've gone from being, you know, basically a business improvement district that, you know, managed real estate assets and, you know, branding for the neighborhood to taking a very serious and committed approach to embedding sustainability. And a couple key projects coming out of the ground in that neighborhood include a district energy facility and efficiency strategy for the Portland Trailblazers that can ultimately grow to serve other customers in the neighborhood. And a three-block, $750 million housing and retail project that is going to give breathe some life into the neighborhood from a housing mix, which it doesn't have much of, and a retail mix, which it doesn't have much of, all with a really interesting water, black water, gray water management system and hyper-efficient energy systems in the mix. Much of that influenced by, you know, the eco district coming online and the business community kind of collectively moving in the direction of these sustainability metrics. So that's just a couple examples of, you know, and I would say the latter example is really what we what we see is where ecodistricts are going. It's not about, it's not about the, sort of put a bubble over a neighborhood and, execute, thinking you're going to sort of have success right away with a bunch of very, very rigorous metrics. It's a process of engaging what we call engagement to governance so that at the end of the day, after a couple, 3 years, you actually have robust governance in that neighborhood leading on the sustainability work. We think that's going to be one of the key contributions we can make in this sort of eco-cities space and eco-district spaces is really trying to jumpstart the amount of sophisticated, legally created district governance structures, whether they come through business improvement districts or neighborhood associations or some other mechanism, to really govern projects and shape how the neighborhood makes investments and obviously shaping those who are making those investments in the neighborhood.
Great. So Brady and Rachel, back to you.
Rachel, would you like to take a stab?
Sure. Thanks again for being on the call with all of us today. And
I'm sorry, it's still there?
Rachel, are you there? She emailed that her phone was possibly on the way to dying, so maybe that is what just happened.
See you then, Brady.
Okay, but she did send me a couple questions she was thinking of asking, and she is actually part of the Waste Management Department for the City of New York, New York City. And she was just wondering basically how you would think about moving, some of the framework and some of these tools into, Manhattan. I know there are some sort of eco-district projects in like the Gowanus area in Brooklyn, but she was focused on Manhattan where you have, these incredibly entrenched political interests. And I think sort of the larger question, how have you found dealing with sort of stakeholders from, various backgrounds and, oftentimes they have long histories of sort of antagonistic relationships. And, while we all like to dream that Portland is the Portlandia version where everybody gets along, we're pretty certain that there are, municipal issues and long histories of tough relationships. So.
Yeah, this is, we go into this with a very practical and sort of eyes wide open approach to the work. This is what we're suggesting is critical here is new models of working together for collective impact. So it's, that collective impact approach, the collaborative governance approach, which we think is going to be critical to success. In Manhattan and other parts of the country that might have a very difficult sort of political structure kind of overlaid at the neighborhood level, or you don't have the kind of alignment within city agencies to deliver services in a more coordinated way, you're going to struggle. And I think, this is, I liken what we're trying to do to, to integrate, to this notion of integrated design at the building level. You may recall, if any of you have been involved in green real estate or green building, that, it was clear once LEED hit the streets that it was calling for a different way for those who design and build and finance buildings to work together. You weren't going to be able to optimize environmental benefits without it. So, there was a lot of work on notions of how you do integrated design and how you actually create financial incentives to the contractors and designers to, really meet sustainability outcomes. I think the same thing exists at the neighborhood level, although it's an even more complicated ecosystem, that you have to find the incentives and the reasons and rationale for why an affordable housing provider would partner with a real estate developer who's doing another project with a city who's delivering infrastructure to a utility provider who's, laying in either natural gas or electric or telecom services. So, but we think that is the nut to crack because all, when you roll up in Manhattan, when you roll up all the amount of investment happening at a neighborhood level, it tends to be very, very significant. And then you got to ask the question, is that development or those investments the right investments, and are they having you know, the kind of impacts on the community that, you know, in the case of the city, they want and need to have, and frankly, in the case of the real estate or housing providers that they need and want to have. That is going to be that is the sort of journey we're on organizationally to find out what those sort of very practical mechanisms of collaboration look like. And then, you know, in some instances, what the policy framework looks like to either incent that behavior or to require that behavior. And we're working with City of San Francisco right now over the last 2 years, one, create a policy framework to define eco-districts, but then to test it in their South of Market area where, you know, they're going to, in the next 10 years alone, generate over $750 million in impact fees to reinvest in the neighborhood. So the city's quite interested in, you know, what is it, you know, given the amount of change in this particular neighborhood where we're going to generate a lot of new development and ultimately have to build new infrastructure, what is, you know, how can we make better decisions using the eco-districts approach? And the, you know, the Tishmans and the other, the Hines and others who have major land holdings in that neighborhood want to understand, okay, if we're in an eco-district, what does that mean? What do we need to do that's different than business as usual? And so that's, you know, these are the conversations that are starting. I wouldn't suggest for a second that we know what those answers all look like. It's really about, you know, forcing those kind of conversations and using the sustainability metrics as the kind of key indicators of success and working with them to embed those indicators into their KPIs for the projects.
Thank you. Eben, do you have a question? I have a couple more, but don't want to hog the okay.
National callers, if they want to, folks dialing in, if you hit 5-star on your phone, we can enable you to answer a call. And for those of you who've just been joining us, you're with the Bard MBA in Sustainability. This is our Sustainable Business Fridays call. And we're talking with Rob Bennett, who is CEO of Eco Districts. So go ahead, Brady, and then we've got a couple calls from folks dialing in.
Okay, great. I guess sort of the question that I always have, you know, obviously there's this focus on cities, you know, with all the trends and whatnot, with, you know, the world moving towards, you know, but what, by 2050, 80% of the world's population is estimated to live in some sort of urban environment. Have you been approached by any sort of rural towns, small towns, et cetera, that are interested in sort of the eco-districts framework but aren't necessarily going to be, you know, booming metropolises? And, you know, I'm just wondering how you think about, you know, the effect that all these trends will have on rural areas and small towns, if you do in your role or if, you know, as a human being, like, how do you think about that dynamic?
Well, we have been, you know, we built the framework to be what we, you know, what we call typology neutral. So, you know, you can apply the framework in the performance areas really to any project of different, you know, of, as far as, you know, different sort of scale and density. You know, we, you know, in Portland, one of our neighborhoods that we worked with in the pilot phase was a very low density, low income community that didn't have, you know, didn't have much of this kind of typical infrastructure you'd find in the city, like sidewalks, you know, good bus service. So I do think it can be applied in smaller communities as well. We were just recently approached and actually heard, you know, there's a small town in West Virginia that's taking an eco-districts approach to their sort of downtown core. Oberlin in Oberlin, Ohio, has got a district project that, you know, is really kind of a town gown project. So I do think, you know, it can apply in smaller communities that, you know, recognize that their neighborhoods, you know, are, you know, critical, sort of have critical impact on how they ultimately, you know, are create livable and sort of humane places to live and ultimately how they meet, if they have them, sustainability metrics. That said, we haven't done a lot of thinking. I mean, the trends as far as how urbanism, you know, ultimately impacts rural areas, you know, that's an area that we don't spend any time in. You know, I have my own opinions about that, but, you know, the fact of the matter that we're urbanizing, you know, for better or for worse, is happening, so we better make sure we do a damn good job of making these cities, you know, humane, livable, resilient. And, you know, I think we have, you know, we're seeing a lot of mediocre results, particularly in the fastest growing parts of the world, India and China, where they're just, you know, they're pumping out development, and you can just, you know, the stories from this early generation work are not good. You know, they're not particularly livable. They're not functioning particularly well for, you know, from a social perspective. You know, that will not be our challenge here in the U.S. I mean, I think our challenge in the U.S., which makes ecodistricts kind of, you know, a very sort of smart, you know, smart strategy, is the recognition that we have to just be smarter with our investments. We need our infrastructure investments to have 2, 3, 4 benefits. They need to, you know, manage stormwater, manage heat island effect, create habitat, create open space, and, oh, by the way, you know, help, you know, move people by pedestrian, you know, by walking and bicycling more effectively. So I think, you know, ecodistricts plays very nicely into that agenda. Ecodistricts plays very nicely into the fact that when we make investments at the neighborhood level, we're trying to also have a conversation about public health and the ability for people to, to sort of manage their own personal health and the overall community health by being smart about, encouraging walking, pedestrian activity, and paying attention to air quality both in and out of buildings. So I think it's, you know, it's intended to be sort of an optimization strategy in which small towns, big towns can, you know, can benefit from that kind of thinking.
Super. We're talking with Rob Bennett, who's CEO of Ecodistricts. My name's Evan Goodstein. I'm director of BAR's MBA in Sustainability. You're with Sustainable Business Fridays. We're a fourth and first Friday of the month phone call. And we've got a great lineup. End of February, we'll be talking with Toby Usnick, who's the Chief Corporate Sustainability Officer at Christie's, about their experience launching a CSR program. Early March, we'll be talking with Dave Tulaskis, who's Director of Sustainability at General Motors, focusing on their interest in moving from good to great at GM sustainability. And then at the end of March, we have a conversation about integrating sustainability as a core business strategy with Dave Stangus, who's VP for Public Affairs and Corporate Responsibility at Campbell Soup Company. So we've got a great lineup coming. If you'd like to learn more about the Sustainable Business Fridays program, just drop us an email at mba@bard.edu. We do have this Saturday from 1 to 2 o'clock, we've got an informational webinar. If you're interested in our MBA program, one of a handful of programs globally that fully integrates sustainability into a core business curriculum, or as well our Masters of Science programs in Environmental Policy and Climate Science and Policy. And again, if you'd like to learn more about those webinars, just drop us an email at mba@bard.edu or visit the website bard.edu/MBA. So I've got, 646-221-7307. You are live to ask a question to Rob.
Great, thanks. Thanks for sharing all these insights. Very interesting. My name is Dan Sicardi. I'm probably with the Clean Tech Group. You've spoken, I think, a little indirectly about this, but can you speak a little bit to how deliberate you were or weren't in looking at some of the history of your U.S. Green Building Council and LEED, as well as the smart growth movement, in terms of how do you not reinvent the wheel? How do you work and be additive to those efforts rather than you're competing with them?
Sure. Yeah, I think it's critical. I mean, there's our role is sort of integrator, if you will. It's really about, focusing on the integrated sustainability outcomes that we think are critical to success. And there's a lot of organizations that are doing good work in pieces and portions of this. So that's kind of where we start. So let's just take, we'll take Smart Growth for a second. You know, Smart Growth America and Congress for New Urbanism, you know, and others have been really advancing and LOCUS, ULI, I'm sorry, LOCUS at Smart Growth America, have been advancing both the sort of design and then the financing aspects of transit-oriented development, smart growth, the land use transportation linkages. So there's been a tremendous amount of work in the last 20 years of advancing, how we connect our real estate to transportation infrastructure, and then ultimately how we finance these mixed-use projects. What I would suggest is missing in those conversations is sort of the deepening sustainability metrics to advance some of those projects in which you start to look at equity, public health, community building, and other sort of governance issues that I think smart growth could benefit from. Green building, we have a partnership with the U.S. Green Building Council. Our framework is intended to help support and ultimately build market share for LEED-ND and for their buildings products. So they see us as a really important partner in advancing the idea of integrated neighborhood or sustainability, in which they have a role to play in advancing certified buildings or certified neighborhoods in the neighborhoods where LEED-ND makes sense. And then, take another partner in the areas of equity, social justice. There's a tremendous amount of expertise and knowledge in organizations like Policy Link and Center for Neighborhood Technology in Chicago and others that have really been working on, the Ella Baker Center in Oakland and Green for All, and advancing community benefit agreements and that link job creation opportunities and pathways from poverty opportunities when you make investments, whether they be infrastructure, clean tech, clean energy investments, or building retrofit investments. So there's these many organizations and their partners are advancing big pieces of what we consider the EcoDistrict's agenda. Our role, I think, is to be a bit of a bridge builder and intermediary between them so we can optimize. And at the end of the day, our mission is about acceleration, and districts. That's the two words, sort of neighborhood district, that matters to us. And many of these instances, many of these organizations, aren't working at that scale. Some are, some aren't. So, we help them bring, and help shine a light on what some of the mechanisms for working at the neighborhood level is that also advance the kind of skills and the kind of success they've had in advancing issues like, transit-oriented development or equity at the neighborhood level.
Great, thanks.
Brady, back to you.
Sure. I have, maybe my final question, and this actually came up when I was working at Spur in San Francisco, which I mentioned to you, Rob. Some of my coworkers were a little skeptical of how you track sort of all of the various tools and tactics that you are rolling out. Obviously, when you're dealing with all of these stakeholders and some of this information is proprietary, how do you one track that either as EcoDistrict's or as in the case of Lloyd. In Portland, you have this new group that is assembled. How do you track it? How do you make that information public? And I guess, then feed into more people buying in as they see the results, because, a lot of this work is sort of underground or, not necessarily visible in the way that, creating an urban forest or whatever is.
Right. Well, I mean, it starts with, we have to recognize the kind of metrics and management at the neighborhood level really doesn't exist, so it's, the classic adage, you can't manage what you can't measure. That's one reason our framework is very explicit in the four steps of having both governance, organization and governance on the front end and management at the back end. Now, the issue of transparency in managing results is an interesting one. What's one area we're going to get into in sort of developing standards for this? There's some really interesting work starting to emerge in the 2030 districts around the country where, each of these property owners who are quite competitive and don't have a tremendous amount of reason to share data are starting to share data because that's what the arrangement calls for. So the governance arrangements for 2030 districts say you will share your energy and carbon data with each other, and then they are sorting out how they, to what level they publicize that data to the broader public. And I mean, our starting point on that is, you know, transparency matters. So if you do annual reporting at the neighborhood level, it should be consistent with, you know, how companies are now looking at reporting their sustainability footprint and their activities. So we don't have an answer specifically for that question because it's all very new, but I would say that our framework and where we are going with our standards development is to insist on, you know, those performance areas being the metrics that you are going to report on and that you have transparent reporting, a transparent reporting sort of vehicle, whether it be annually or sort of, you know, as you're starting to see in some cases, you know, literally in real time in certain areas that you can do real-time data collection and reporting be part of the mix. You know, if it, you know, take the Soma district in San Francisco, you know, that's a very complicated district with thousands of property owners, you know, from the most sophisticated global leaders in real estate to, you know, a family who's owned the building for 100 years. The ability to measure success will really lie in determining what the kind of data that they can collect and how you ultimately can sort of manage that data, not only collection, but reporting over time. So, you know, the utility could certainly aggregate the energy data in that neighborhood and show movement over time. The water utility can do the same on water usage. And that's kind of where you start is, you know, in this process of building an ecodistrict and applying these eight performance areas is you start to understand what you can, what can be measured, what is important in that district to measure, what's important for, not just, you know, what is important within the district as far as what did they feel is most important, and ultimately building reporting protocols around that. So, you know, long way of saying we are certainly in the business of insisting on that, that kind of transparency and reporting, but that journey is just beginning and sort of issues around privacy, data quality, metrics is all going to be, I think, part of what happens in the next few years as projects get online.
You know, one of the interesting things here is your choice of name, because, you know, you're pulling together environmental, social justice, you know, fair housing, livability, sort of the whole gamut of stuff that often fits under the definition of sustainability. But the choice to go with eco is really interesting, and I'm wondering, is that a, you know, do people embrace that label as kind of trendy and cool, or does that sort of pose problems if you were to move into, more red states and cities with that sort of approach?
Yeah, you know, that's a question we get asked a lot, and you know, I wish I could say to you, we did lots of market research and focus groups, and you know, we just kind of created the Uber name. It is a name that is sticking for reasons that you know aren't totally clear to us. It seems to have good brand recognition. Now, is it what you start with in a, you know, like you say, a red state? I mean, I could tell you. You know, Orlando, Charleston, Atlanta. There's projects in the South, and you know, even in, you know, Rust Belt cities that are sort of fully throated working on ecodistrict projects. My hunch is that they're gonna brand it themselves. What matters for them, right? It may start as, you know, the organization is ecodistrict. We're promoting integrated sustainability solutions, but as organizations take on or cities or regions or neighborhoods take on their agenda, they will, I assume, brand it to meet the local culture and to try to sort of address those issues. You know, we're not really, you know, at the point where we're thinking we're, you know, needing to deal with the you know, the sort of politics of, you know, the most extreme conservatives in this country. I mean, we're just, you know, let's face it, we're a new organization, and we're going to, projects will be built out in those communities in which there's mojo, energy, and commitment. You know, they will not, this is not a, this is an early adopter, you know, space that we're in. And what's been encouraging is that, you know, there seems to be appetite, you know, in some of the more unusual places that, you know, either haven't been particularly exemplary on being municipal leaders in sustainability like New York, or, you know, don't have a tremendous track record in awesome real estate, you know, transit-oriented development real estate, or, you know, redevelopment. So now probably what will happen in those places, even if they attempt to do ecodistrict, they will struggle, because it really does require, you know, it requires a level of best practice application and a variety of disciplines, from complete streets to, you know, transit-oriented development to, you know, public health indicators. So this is going to be something, I think, that's going to really emerge most powerfully in those cities that have built some of that infrastructure to begin. But just like it did with green building, you know, it was, you know, you could count the number of cities that were doing green building in the first 5 years on two hands. I think, you know, likewise, eco-districts will, you know, start to be applied in, you know, in those more, in those cities and towns that have got both appetite but also systems to sort of apply it more easily.
We've got a call from 212-785-207. 212-785-2207.
Hi, this is Nancy Anderson, the director of the Salon Foundation. This is the first time I've had an opportunity to participate in one of these Friday Sustainable Biz webinars. It's really outstanding. Rob, I have a couple of questions for you. They're all related, but I think they're not quite in the right order. Although I'm now at the Salon Foundation, I did spend 20 years in city government here in New York, and a part of that time was spent working with communities out in Greenpoint, Williamsburg, and in West Harlem on community environmental benefit programs, and came away from that experience having learned a lot, but also with, I got to say, a bunch of bumps and bruises and abrasions that left me with guarded optimism about being able to get communities to self-organize into eco districts. So my two questions for you is, what seems to work best to get the eco district idea sort of in the door and get urban communities willing to sit down at a table together where you don't assume consensus by any means, but consensus and agreement have to be created. So what gets you in the door? And then once you're in the door, how to ensure that everyone who's there from a given community meeting together, everyone has their voices heard?
A great question, and I would agree, as someone who's done community organizing, that the notion that sort of communities can come to consensus is a pretty hard one to imagine. You know, using kind of the kind of tools and techniques that we've traditionally been using for many, many years. The place we start is to look for some key leadership champions, both at the city level and at the local level. So here in Portland, there's been a very successful project in the Cully neighborhood, which is a low-income, primarily Hispanic-serving neighborhood, in which a threesome of organizations that serve the neighborhood, a housing CDC, a social enterprise organization, and that's sort of a job creation organization, and then a Native American youth and training center have partnered to create the Cully Eco District. And so as three very, I'd say, sophisticated and, historically, you know, sort of have served that neighborhood and done good work in housing and training and building social enterprise. They wanted to go to the next level to sort of look at how they integrate across the sort of service delivery spectrum that they work, and to look at the neighborhood sort of from a more holistic perspective and sort of work on projects that they thought would be the, you know, real game changers in that neighborhood. Now, they had to partner, you know, for that neighborhood success, they had to partner with the city. And so, I do view success factors for eco-districts being very much a public, civic partnership. First, often starting with a key, organization with some level of heft, if you will, in the neighborhood, and then a very willing to innovate municipal government. I don't know a lot about New York, but certainly it seems like, the last 10 years in New York especially, there's been, a lot of work, obviously in the sustainability space and getting some level of success by doing some new things, by approaching transportation in a more integrated fashion, to really trying to move on a green infrastructure strategy in the city. And in that, and what that sort of requires is agencies to work differently, to test kinds of best practices in a different way, to think about how labor rolls out, et cetera, et cetera. So our test masters, want our key organization within a neighborhood or two or three that are working together or willing to work together, and then a city who's willing to come to the table and say, yeah, we're willing to deploy resources and services in a more integrated fashion at the neighborhood level, and we're willing to pilot the idea. Let me use an example. So in the Portland example, because those base organizations were organizing, they were able to go to the city in a more collective way to start to negotiate contracts to build a new park and actually to bypass typical park building procurement and labor to hire local labor and do a local design competition that also allowed foundations to enter in to help build a park in a park deficient neighborhood that, if we followed the city's park master plan, wouldn't be done for 20 years. So they sped up a park planning process by 20 years. They used local labor that was organized by the organizations, and that is one of their key projects as a Cully Eco District. You couldn't get there without the city being flexible and creative, and you certainly couldn't get there without the community organizations having a level of sophistication and dedication. In the Lloyd Eco District here in Portland, we were organizing we were helping facilitate the effort, and it was a bumpy road initially to get all these major property owners who are all sophisticated in their own right, whether it's Kaiser or a professional sports franchise, or they don't tend to work they think of sustainability in the same way and use the same metrics. But over time, we used a process with the intermediary, in which we created declarations of cooperation using a collective impact approach. And it took about a year of negotiations and meetings to get to agree to some common metrics of impact and measuring success, and then arranging the kind of investment, the co-investments between the city and the property owners. So 10 property owners funded at the $10,000 in, the city matched, and that became a three-year pilot that ultimately got institutionalized with the Business Improvement District funding through their own assessment this new eco district. So in a more commercially serving neighborhood, it just took a lot of negotiations between the parties to get there. But they did, I must say, they all started with, a real interest in the eco district because they understood, I think, the value, having worked somewhat together in other projects, of collective action. The downtown Washington, D.C. bid, which is 90 million square feet, is all over eco districts because they see the value of having to have created a shadow government when the government fell apart, when the city was bankrupted in the late 90s. You know, they stepped up and became a shadow government for their downtown district. So they get the sort of inherent value. Neighborhoods are, you know, all come in all shapes and sizes, and some are so entrenched with really difficult politics that, you know, many of these I don't think would be the early adopter neighborhoods for eco-districts. Although one of our neighborhoods here in Portland, you know, a classically sort of a Saul Alinsky kind of style neighborhood that's been fighting the city for years, underinvested, lots of bad investments that had been made, they are embracing eco-districts because I think they see it as a new way to get positive outcome, and it's not sort of in the typical kind of style of fight and struggle with the city. So some early lessons, you know, I'm not sure I could draw too many conclusions. You know, this is a very complicated area. We hope through our framework that we can contribute to some new models of how neighborhood sustainability gets done and how we can frame the issues in a more positive way, kind of avoid some of the pitfalls of the kind of issues that bedevil neighborhoods and particularly their relationship with the city. You know, you certainly wouldn't start in the most entrenched and difficult neighborhoods, I don't think, as far as those relationships go. It's got to go to where there's a willingness for the leadership, both at the local level and at the city level, to try a new approach to some of the work that, you know, has been going on for some time.
Well, Rob, thank you so much for joining us today. We're actually out of time, and that was actually a pretty good summary, I think, of how to make progress in this area. It's really exciting to hear about this work. It's sort of rolling up, you know, we've had a number of sort of initiatives like LEED and others that have sort of tackled sectoral issues, but to see kind of a neighborhood concept emerging around best practices is very cool, very exciting. So again, just closing out, we've got some terrific speakers coming up. Late February, we'll be hearing from the sustainability directors at Christie's, and then in March, General Motors, as well as the Campbell Soup Company. So this has been Sustainable Business Fridays. Brady McCartney, thank you for inviting Rob Bennett on today. It's been a pleasure to talk with everybody. We'll see you.
Yeah, thank you, Rob.
Thank you. It was fun. Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye, everybody.